This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Man! And then there was one, and it was Sting, and he didn't look too good.
Hulkamania! Hulk Hogan is here!
Hulk Hogan's here!
Hulk Hogan is in the building!
You damn right he is!
Go get him, Hulkster!
Yeah, but whose side is he on?
Go, what are you talking about?
Whose side is he on?
What are you talking about?
Yes, sir!
Get him, Hogan! Go get him, baby!
Come on and get some of this now!
Who's bad now, boys?
Hulk Hogan arrived! Hook!
What is he doing?
Oh, my God!
Is he the third man?
He's the third man!
What the hell is going on here?
Hulk Hogan has betrayed WCW! He is the third man
in
this picture!
Oh, my God!
What the hell is going on?
Oh, my God!
Are you kidding me?
Probably the lowest shot ever given to professional wrestling. That man did right there, Hulk Hogan.
Let's get everybody out of the dressing room right now and kick his rear end.
Unbelievable, brother.
You just What have I been saying all these years?
Oh my God.
A career of a lifetime.
It's
right down the drain, kid. I hope you love it.
Can you see
just
those
sold your soul to the devil.
See those little Hulksters with the tears rolling down their face right now?
We are not going to even acknowledge that three count.
Now what happens to us? What happens now to WCW?
There was no three count. I never thought I would say that he's yellow, but he may be wearing red, but he's wearing red and yellow.
What do we do now?
What a low. I'll tell you what. This is a unbelievable situation right here at Bash at the Beach. Hulkamania, the third guy with the Outsiders, betrayed WCW.
Can't talk.
Well, I told you so.
Hey everybody, pull up a beach chair, put on your suntan lotion. It is summertime, the living is easy. Welcome to another edition of PTBN Rewind. This is your monthly look back at some of the biggest shows in wrestling history. I'm your host, Ben Morse. Highly significant wrestling pay-per-view to discuss tonight, and a pair of fine fellows to talk about professional wrestling late or late-ish on a Friday night. Of course, that's not when you guys are listening to this, but that's when we're recording. I'm going to bring these guys right in because we got a lot to talk about tonight. Up first, a Southern gentleman, co-host of Where the Big Boys Play, co-host of the legendary Brad and Chad show. It's kind of like Haley's Comet. It just comes around every once in a while. Good buddy of mine. We once spent about 7 hours talking about the Emmys and put Justin Rosero to sleep. Double C, Chad Campbell, how are you?
Doing good. We'll see if we can put Brad to sleep tonight, who's running in the background.
Yeah.
Keep our streak alive.
I feel like Brad finds us more interesting, so we'll have to work harder, but that's never a problem for us.
Sure. I'm up to the task.
And a real pleasure, our second guest tonight, second man on the panel. If Chad is the Southern gentleman, this is the Northern gentleman. If you are like me, you've read his books. You've read his blog over at rspwfaq.com and been getting his thoughts on wrestling for years now, kind of the voice of a generation here, coming back to talk about a time he knows a lot about, and that is none other than Scott Keith. Scott, welcome to PTBN Rewind.
Hey, thanks, guys. So just to clarify here, am I supposed to make fun of Boston sports teams for you guys, or is there other things that I'm supposed to like take shots at?
You can feel free to take shots at a Boston sports team. I am a native Bostonian living in New Jersey and working in New York, so believe me, it is.
Oh, man, that's like the worst combination. Oh, God.
It is nothing new for me. Actually, it's weird. The New Jersey, if anyone knows the area, it's like New Jersey is almost like a refuge for us because they don't like New York either. So it's kind of a it's a neutral deal where they're like, oh yeah, you know, you guys are friend of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, that type of deal. So, but yeah, if you want to take shots, go nuts.
Well, I do feel somewhat relieved that Calgary will be getting the UFC instead of New York on some level.
I'm right there with you, my friend. I'm okay with that. Fine city of Calgary deserves all it can get. So, guys, we tonight are going to be discussing Bash at the Beach 1996. Of course, WCW's offering from July of that year. As I said in the beginning, hugely historically significant show. We're going to talk about more than just the big history-making stuff. Of course, we'll dig into that, but there's a lot of stuff going on here. WCW was a promotion transforming, as it seemed to be for much of its existence, but 1996 was when they really started to turn the tide in the Monday Night Wars, started to become a legitimate contender. Scott, you've been talking all about 1996 over on your blog, so I was hoping you could kind of set things up for us here. What's the state of WCW in July 1996? What's going on with them and their ongoing competition with the WWF? And both, you know, in retrospect and how you were viewing at the time, where did you see them going?
Well, this was a really weird period for me because living in Canada, we didn't really have much perspective on WCW out there. Like when, going through watching these Nitros now, right? Like this is the first time I've seen any of this stuff.
Right.
So like, you know, I would order the pay-per-views, but like, you know, the weekly shows, it's like really my only exposure to it was what I saw on WCW Saturday Night at the time. And it's kind of really interesting to get a whole other view of what was going on. And, At that point, I'd have to say things were very, very up and down for the company. They were experimenting with the 2-hour format on Nitro for the first time, which was, there was some growing pains involved in that, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I think though, watching them, like we didn't realize at the time just how huge that the NWO invasion would become. If we're talking about this time period, I mean, it really was the Hulk Hogan turn that, that set everything off the way it was. And it was kind of, it just kind of felt like a company kind of, you know, they're in solid competition with WWF, but mm-hmm. It didn't feel like WWF was really like turning the corner downwards like they would at that point. It felt really a lot more even and not like the atomic bomb on the landscape of wrestling that it would turn into after this pay-per-view, I think.
This is something we'll get into as we go on and, you know, discuss kind of the bigger picture. But do you feel like at this point it was almost... was it a case of Vince not knowing how to react because he'd never had true competition like this? Or was it a kind of hubris where he was like, whatever they're doing is not going to work? Because you're right, it did feel at the time like WCW, even before the Hogan turn, really, they had something cooking, they had something edgy, and WWF didn't seem like they were going out of their way to respond. They were just kind of staying the course.
Yeah, well, the way they responded, of course, was the Billionaire Ted skits, which was a typical Vince way of dealing with these things, right? And and it's just that's how he knew to respond to this kind of stuff. And it was, I think, it was just it was more the fact that he never had true competition, like somebody like Eric Bischoff, who would, you know, kind of sink to his level and even further below in order to kind of do anything to win, right? And
he had to.
Vince was used to dealing with the old boy promoters who did things a certain way and didn't have the balls to stand up to him. And, you know, this was the first time that somebody was coming at him head to head. And it took a long time to really figure out how to deal with it, I think.
Yeah. Now, Chad, you're a different perspective because whereas Scott was, you know, not totally being able to follow the WCW product, I was a Northeast guy, so I was more familiar with WWF, kind of dipped my toes in WCW. You were in the South. You were fully exposed to WCW. Was this the type of thing where you were excited to finally see kind of, I don't want to describe it as your home promotion, but, you know, the company that was closer to you turn things around? Or were you a WWF guy who was not fully convinced that this was going to make an impact?
Well, I mean, when I first got into wrestling, it was because of Hulk Hogan.
Right.
So I was pretty WWF-centric for the first few years. And then in kind of 94, 95, when Hogan dropped off, and I like Brett, but he never filled the void that Hogan did, and I started venturing more into WCW, really got invested in the Dustin Rhodes versus Stud Stable feud. That's actually the thing that got me watching WCW more. And then 95 is just like a blur for both companies, really. So the thing I liked about kind of leading up to this angle and leading up to this moment in time, because this was one of the pay-per-views that I remember actually ordering, and I was pretty sporadic in ordering pay-per-views around this time, but I just like the sense that even though WCW was bringing something different to the table with the cruiserweights and still had some Southern aspects, they were also now, it felt like with the outsiders coming in, a different type of angle. Even as a kid, it was something that felt different and something that I really hadn't seen up to that point in my wrestling fandom, kind of that type of angle done. So it was really exciting. I can remember kind of there being a lot of buzz around our we were building a house in Alabama at the time this pay-per-view took place, and I remember the builders, when we would go over there to see the update, the builders were actually talking and speculating on who the third man would be.
That's awesome.
So there was some, it seemed like this did have some kind of mainstream appeal, kind of in the southern region I lived in.
Yeah. That's like Bobby Heenan level, you know, they're talking about in the airport stuff like, oh yeah, the guy's working on my house or speculating who the third man is. That's right. Great. I love it. You mentioned the cruiserweights. We're going to get to them in a sec because they kick off the show, but I would be remiss if I did not mention the, and even if you watch this on WWE Network, I love that this was still intact, the opening video, you know, showing the hostile takeover and all that. But the most important thing to me is that the clear ripoff of Seal's Crazy still fully intact instrumental version playing in the background.
I think that's hilarious because you watch it on the network now and you think, oh my God, they, you know, the idiots of the network have, you know, done another one of their hatchet jobs. But no, that was actually, yeah, the original ripoff version that WCW used at the time, which I think is just so WCW. It's like, you're spending all this money. Why don't they just shell out a few extra bucks and get the real thing, you'd wonder.
It was amazing to me because I was 14 years old when this was going on, and I was not a Seal guy then. I would later, you know, become a huge devotee of the magician that is the musical magician that is Seal. But at the time, yeah, this was just the soundtrack of the hostile takeover because they used this song for every video package for probably the next 3 or 4 months, consistently with the same subject footage. But yeah, I had to note that, and I'm glad you had a thought on it as well, Scott, because it made me feel warm inside hearing those, that familiar refrain, but not too familiar. Chad talked about the cruiserweights. Cruiserweights become a huge part of WCW around this time. The cruiserweight title had just been established in the spring of 1996. We will see that champion in action later in the show. But the opening match, kind of a famous one. Rey Mysterio, in only his second pay-per-view match, taking on Psicosis, who I believe is making his pay-per-view debut. Rey had made a splash the month before at the Great American Bash. Psicosis, of course, these guys had worked together in Mexico. They'd worked together in ECW. This was a chance for these guys to really go out and prove themselves. They have a 15-minute match. It's very fast-paced, very back and forth, unlike a lot of what people had seen from WCW, even to this point when they had started bringing in, you know, some of the Japanese guys. But, you know, you still had your Dean Malenkos, your Brad Armstrongs. This is kind of an eye opener. And I know for a while, you in particular, Scott, have called this, you know, one of the better opening matches of pay-per-view history, I believe, right? You have held this in very high regard.
That is correct. Yeah. I for a long time, this one was up there with Bret Nolan and a couple other ones as definitely one of the greatest pay-per-view openers of all time, I thought. Which is really weird, actually. As far as Ray goes, like, his treatment in the first couple of months was actually kind of strange, I felt. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the match with Dean Malenko, watching it now, you can tell Dean really kind of gobbles him up the whole match. Like, yeah, this guy who they presumably signed to come in and fly around the ring and do a whole different style. But at the time, this wasn't a thing yet in WCW, right? Like, nobody knew what these guys were going to come in here and do. So they kind of had Dean come in, and it was kind of the equivalent of somebody like, you know, Chris Jericho coming into WWF and learning to work WWF style or, you know, whatever. You know, the problem was at the time, right? And Dean really held him down with a lot of mat work. And I mean, it was a really good match, but I mean, like, reading the observers from the time as well, I mean, Meltzer was very, very disappointed in Ray's performance there. And I think this was the first time where they basically put him out there with another luchador who could do the same things he did and just totally let them cut loose. And I think this actually, this match doesn't get enough credit, I think, for really revolutionizing that aspect of the business, because this was the one where they went out there and they just tore the house down in the pay-per-view opener, and nobody else could follow them. And that's where everybody really saw what Rey Mysterio can do if he had a chance to cut loose, I think.
Chad, using this as an example, but, you know, kind of speaking from the historical reference as well, what makes for a good opening match? Not just, you know, a good match, but a good opener, and why does this fit into that category?
I think energy really plays a big part in the opening match. You want a crowd that's hot. You want to be engaged in the show right from the beginning. I always think an opening match is a fairly important match. I think this one certainly is a level above almost all opening matches on pay-per-view. I'd still have this probably top five, top ten. I mean, to me, like, Bret Owen is a tier on its own. And then I have this in tier two with, like, Pillman, Liger, and Orient Express Rockers from Rumble 91. And then this match, and maybe like the Vengeance 03 Guerrero Benoit match, which I liked. But I think good energy, really high, fast-paced action. And this is that type of match where I equate this a lot with the Pillman-Liger match. It probably has a little less wrestling, but it does start out with a little wrestling base, and the crowd's respectful. But by the end of the match, they're really into it and really cheer Ray on when he makes his comeback and is just kind of amazed by the moves that when he finally is able to reverse the Splash Mountain into the Hunikarana and pick up the win, you really get that huge reaction. So not only did both competitors get over themselves by providing a fast-paced, really high action, just crazy bumps in the match that Senton Psychosis does to the floor is just nasty. But I think they also were able to tell a story, and the crowd was able to follow it along, and it really made both men, to me, and Ray especially.
It's also interesting picking up on something that Scott said about how basically influential this match would end up being, because not long after, you know, all the cruiserweights started becoming a staple of WCW, but more than that, even, you know, just American-born guys, this is the type of stuff they would start to emulate. And it's crazy to think before July of 1996, this wasn't a thing. You know, this wasn't this high-flying go out there. There was a few, like you mentioned, Liger and Pillman, but nothing quite like this. So I guess both of you guys, I wanted to talk a little bit more before we move on to the rest of the card, just how this match changed the game, not just in terms of, you know, opening matches or how high flyers work, but in terms of how WCW would start booking their mid-card, in particular the cruiserweights and the Lucha Libre guys. Scott, how big a deal was this match? Because I feel like it does get lost a little bit, even though people do have it on their, you know, their top lists.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing in this one was that it immediately resulted, of course, in Rey Mysterio ending up with the Cruiserweight title, which was,
right,
I think it was the night after this at the Orlando tapings.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It was right away. That was, and I, you could argue that, like, the When Worlds Collide show was also very influential, more so in getting the guys into WCW, right? But this was the one that really let them know that they could bring in however many random cruiserweights they wanted to fill up the Nitro shows, which was another actually very important thing that this changed. Up until this point, they were doing, like, you know, four or five of the 2-hour Nitros before that. And they were very hit or miss. They were bringing in guys like the Rock and Roll Express and other warm bodies to kind of, you know, fill up a 2-hour thing. And they had no real concept of how to actually fill a 2-hour show at that point. And this match was really neat in that it lets them know that, hey, you know, if you have 2 hours to fill, you could bring in these two guys from Mexico, put them out there for 15 minutes, and, you know, blow the crowd away, basically, with the match, with, you know, kind of any given combination of these luchadors they bring in there. And that was a real important piece of the puzzle for Nitro, because that was, it kind of became the defining thing of the mid-card on Nitro that they were lacking up until that point, which is where beforehand they were filling it up with, like the Disco Infernos and other like losers and geeks like that. And now they had an actual defined mid-card crew that could go out there and just, have a good match on any given night, which is really, really important to the kind of long-term benefit of the show, I think.
Right. It is kind of the contrast of how, the NWO was a big deal in terms of turning the tide, but it's, these guys were kind of, they were the grunts out on the front lines, and they were the ones who got a lot of the work done. Chad, I know it's hard with, 20 years of retrospective to put yourself back in the position, but watching this in July of 1996, did you have any concept of how big a deal Rey Mysterio would be? Did you think he would be kind of a brief attraction, a guy like almost like a Liger who would be a special thing that was brought in once in a while? Or could you see like, okay, this guy's going to be a big star who's going to cross over?
Yeah, I didn't get that sense just watching him around this time. I kind of just saw him as somebody that could do spectacular moves, and it's only later on that I've gained a greater appreciation for kind of some of his storytelling matches, like that match with Malenko at Great American Bash is a match that I really like in retrospect, but probably didn't like as much at the time. So I do think like this type of match would have been more effective as his first debut match, just because it's more spectacular just in the spots.
Right.
But I was really lost on kind of, I guess, the influential aspect of what they were doing. It was just kind of dazzling action in my eyes at the time that I wasn't used to. I mean, the tape trading scene now looking back retrospectively is, around this time, it's almost kind of like a bridge where it was still pretty underground, especially with Lucha, where you would have some people that were accumulating the early AAA stuff from 93 through 95, kind of that golden years of AAA once they started. But it was still pretty rare, and I think definitely Japanese wrestling, if you were in that niche of a niche with tape trading for international tapes, Japanese wrestling was still much more prominent with the Best of the Super Juniors, New Japan Juniors, and stuff like that with Liger.
So we had a lot to say about the opening match. It's a significant match. It's a lot to talk about. A match that is not as significant and that I don't think we will have as much to say about is our following contest, which is Big Bubba, Dungeon of Doom member, Proud, taking on John Tenta with half a haircut. Not just in any match, though, guys. This was a Carson City Silver Dollar match, which when I was thinking back, I was like, okay, I remember that they had to grab some coins off of a pole. I remember that the pole was there before the match started. I did not remember the name of it. What's interesting to me about this is as we start talking about, the cruiserweights revolutionizing WCW, as we start talking about the NWO being a huge deal, we still have kind of what Chad was mentioning earlier, the stuff that kind of glazed you over in WCW throughout 1995, 1996, which was a lot of Dungeon of Doom stuff, characters who were just kind of going through the motions. Scott, you have been writing about Nitro since its inception, so you have seen the evolution of these two characters who, over the course of just 95 and 96, have changed significantly, both somewhat holdovers from a bygone era. Tell us a little bit about what was happening in this Big Bubba versus John Tenta match and how it represents the fact that even though WCW may have been turning a corner, they weren't quite there yet.
Well, I mean, John Tenta did give an awesome promo where he told everybody that he was not a shark.
So, yes.
I mean, he clarified that one. I mean, because I was worried about that. I was like, is this a man? Is this a genetic mutant?
I gotta know.
But yeah, yeah. He looked good. I will say as well, and there was one amazing moment in the build-up for the match when, in between Bubba cutting his hair and all the other ridiculousness, to set this one up, like Bubba came out and it was on Nitro a couple of weeks before this show, and basically whacked him in the face with a sock, right?
Yeah.
That turned out to be full of silver dollars.
Of course.
And it's like, you look at it, and it's like, and he just whacked this guy like right in the eyeball with this thing. And it's like, how do you gimmick that sock? Like, he turns it over and there's this legitimately like seems like a pound of silver dollars in there. So I mean, either they had some really impressive sleight of hand there, or else John Henta was really taking one for the team. So, you know, I gotta give him props at least for that. I mean, that was
absolutely
pretty darn impressive. But
did they ever explain how the Carson City silver dollars in the sock became Big Bubba's signature weapon?
Yeah, I don't know. They were looking for a lot of stuff for Bubba at this point, considering he was changing gimmicks every week, it seemed like.
True.
I still never had a clear explanation of how he went from, you know, chartered accountant Bubba to, you know, biker Bubba with the Dungeon of Doom again. Like, they really just kind of glossed over that changeover, I think. And
I mean, it's a bad crowd. He's running with a bad crowd. He's not dressing as nicely anymore.
I know. I guess so. I mean, it was really kind of baffling character change on his part. There didn't seem to be any clear reason for it, because it's not like his push was any different from one thing to another. He was still Big Bubba, but now he's just dressing like a biker instead of an accountant, right? So
yeah. Dungeon of Doom had that effect on people. I mean, it's the same way Conan went from a upstanding Mexican superhero to a guy straight out of the barrio wearing jeans that didn't fit and flannels that were buttoned up at the top. It was just that Dungeon of Doom effect.
Yeah, and the other thing, the other wacky thing about this match was that, you have these two, 350-pound guys competing for a sock from quarters that you put it on top of a pole.
It did seem very counterintuitive.
Like, yeah, what did they expect there? Like, you had to send poor Jimmy Hart up there to go climb the pole and get it. Like, you know, why don't you put it a little bit lower in a place where they can both get it, you know, just hanging in the corner or something like that. Don't make it so much of a challenge.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know, it's just... It's weird booking all around, I think, and then I don't really get why Bubba lost the match either, because it seems like he was building up to him getting something of a push, and he didn't. He lost, and then John Tenta got squashed by the Giant on Nitro, and I don't know, it's just because WCW, I guess, but it was just, you watching it now in retrospect, all the Nitros leading up to it, it makes even less sense, and I had no idea where they were going with it.
I think you covered it nicely, and I think that last statement kind of sums up the match well. The match after that, Diamond Dallas Page, who you guys who maybe didn't watch at the time or haven't gone back and watched, have to understand that DDP was not the guy he would later become. Certainly not a yoga guru yet, but not even multi-time world champion DDP. At this point, he's kind of going through a transitional phase where he's going from cigar-chomping, over-the-top, heel Diamond Dallas Page. He had proven some of his bona fides by winning a very weak field at Battle Bowl at Slamboree and becoming Lord of the Ring. He'd been kind of building momentum over the past few months, picking up wins against guys like Marcus Alexander Bagwell on pay-per-view and other stuff. He runs headlong here into good old Hacksaw Jim Duggan. So we got DDP versus Duggan in a taped fist match, which had been Duggan's gimmick for on and off like a year at this point. I think his grandmother was like a taped fist champion or something like that. You know, if anyone has more
gimmick, yes.
Yeah, that was the gimmick. So
his grandmother in Ireland, that's correct. Yeah.
His grandmother in Ireland.
That's
so,
right, best straight from Bobby Heenan.
So basically Duggan's gimmick was just, you know, he was allowed to tape his fist, which is of course highly illegal. And gives you quite an advantage, but he would just do it. And he would have these series of taped fist matches where he would just beat the crap out of people. DDP pulls out the win here, though, beats Duggan in his own match, gets a rare pinfall victory over Jim Duggan, actually. Doesn't happen a lot. Nails him with a diamond cutter here. Still gets knocked out after the match. Chad, I want to ask you a similar question to what I asked you about Ray, and that's that given what DDP would become, when he's here kind of screwing around in the mid-card, hasn't quite found his footing either as a worker or as a character, but seems to be getting there. Did you see something in DDP? Did you think this guy could go beyond being just the guy foiling Jim Duggan, or did this seem to be where he fit at this point?
I think we're right on the verge of where you see that transformation. I think in 95, in my mind, he kind of became a decent worker, just kind of in knowing what he could do in the ring and kind of trying to find his way. 96, that really grows. So this is kind of right in the middle of it. I did think this was impressive that he did go over Duggan clean, like you mentioned. I mean, that's really over Duggan's career. That was pretty rare, especially up to this point. I mean, I would not think that happened very often. Of course, on Place to Be podcast, they talked about Duggan's one-loss record on televised matches in WWF, but even in WCW, I mean, U.S. champion and other, I mean, this was somebody that did not lose clean that often,
right?
Especially in his type of gimmick match. So this was, on the surface, it looks like just another, you know, mid-card win for DDP, kind of rising up the ranks a bit. I guess it's kind of hard to think like what type of plans they had for him
right
at this stage, because on one hand, him getting this win shows they had some backing behind him, but I still don't think they thought he would become, you know, what he would become in like 98, where he was one of kind of the true cornerstones of the promotion, really. So
I mean, it feels in retrospect kind of like, you know, the fact that he was friendly with Bischoff aside, I do think, you know, knowing the story of DDP now, the way he started late, the way he worked so hard at the power plant, I think he felt like a guy a lot of people liked. So it made sense that they kind of always had him on the back burner of, okay, we'll do stuff like give him wins over Jim Duggan. And if there's ever a chance to push this guy to, like, put him to the next level, that'd be great. But it may or may not happen. I don't know. Scott, did you get that sense of there was always hope that something would happen with DDP on the behalf of the powers that be, or was it just a fluke when he did eventually end up breaking through?
Well, I mean, everybody liked him. That's the thing. Like,
yeah.
There was, I mean, you know, he was a very likable guy, and there was a lot of people who were, yeah, definitely pushing for him. I mean, like with the Diamond Cutter, that is one of WCW's, actually, like, one of their greatest things as far as getting a finishing move over like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you watch Nitro from week to week, right, I mean, DDP is just laying dudes out with that thing week after week after week, and nobody kicks out of it. And that's one thing that's really lacking in WWE right now is just, like, that, you know, the suddenly unbeatable finishing move, right? Like, it's kind of, you know, guys traded back and forth all the time. But that move was, like, really severely protected, which was kind of a cool thing to watch. You're going back over it now. My major pet peeve with DDP around this time is the benefactor angle, which, which was this big thing that was intended to actually get him kind of to that next level as a heel. And then they just, when the NWO angle came in, they just dropped it and never followed up on it again. And there would have been so many easy ways to do it. But that one drives me crazy because they spent a lot of time on that, and it's really nonsensical character arc if you think about it. And then if you don't, without it, because it's just, you know, some mysterious benefactor makes an anonymous donation and gets him out of the gutter, and then, yeah, you never hear about it again. And that could have been a really big deal, and like I said in my original review of this show, that could have been an easy way to, you know, work in this thing with the NWO, where you reveal that it's Ted DiBiase, the $1 million man, who saved him, and, you know, that's why they're trying to recruit him into the NWO, and then, you know, he turns around and tells him to get lost, and, I mean, it worked fine the way it was, but, just that seems like one of the bigger wasted opportunities for a really big character arc that DDP could have had, unfortunately.
Was it a casualty?
I mean, I liked him all off.
Was it a casualty of the NWO kind of becoming the focus of the promotion? I feel like a lot of things that were kind of, you know, simmering, and we'll discuss a few more later, just kind of died off. Was that kind of a minor casualty of the NWO needing a lot more attention?
I think it was just because WCW were stupid. And they didn't. It was like a lot of things around this time. They introduced stuff, and they just didn't know where they were going with it, and just never bothered to finish following up on it. Like Savage and his briefcase full of money in the alimony with Ric Flair, that deal, right? Too, right? Which kind of died off after a while.
Fair enough. All right, guys, breaking away from the matches for a sec, what I want to talk about is throughout the night, you know, they're doing the interviews, the backstage interviews. It was very reminiscent of, like, you know, as many things were with WCW when it came to the format of the announcers and the interviews and stuff like that, resembled not too far away from an early 90s WWF show, where throughout the night you would have guys talking about matches maybe coming up next, maybe coming up in a few. But kind of the cool thing I thought they utilized here with Mean Gene backstage, whether he was talking to, you know, Flair or Conan or Savage, Sting and Luger, or whoever, was they ran this angle throughout the show of letting you know that even though these matches are going on, and it didn't get to the point where it got later where you know, WCW would almost get criticized a lot for the announcers focusing entirely on the NWO and ignoring what was going on in the ring entirely. I thought they had a nice balance here where they're like, okay, you know, your match matters. I want to talk about your match. But hey, also, who do you think the third guy is? Do you think they were doing a better job with that, Chad, just in terms of integrating this NWO angle throughout the show and, you know, reminding you that it's there, but also being able to kind of continue moving things along?
Yeah, I thought the announcing was really good.
Absolutely.
Throughout the night, with one exception that we'll get to later on. probably most people know what I'm referring to. But the balance they struck here was really strong. And then this, again, I do think this pay-per-view felt like so much more of a consequence than what you were seeing in WCW on pay-per-view throughout most of 96, 95. That it didn't seem as an annoying. I mean, you know, like Bischoff mm-hmm. yelling that they're gonna have a monster truck battle between Hogan and Giant. That's makes you roll your eyes. But this was something that, legitimately, like I said, you know, casual people were talking about, and there was a lot of intrigue. And to your point, Ben, that you said they did not still put the matches on the back burner, so they would just sort of sprinkle in just enough to keep that kind of in the back of your mind, and there was a sense of unease throughout the whole pay-per-view that it was really building up to the main event and who the third guy would be. The stuff with Mean Gene backstage I really enjoyed. I think besides the Ric Flair stuff at Starrcade 93, where Gene's at his home and they ride the limo to the arena, this is probably my favorite kind of Mean Gene WCW investigative reporter type stuff that he did, where he was constantly back there, kind of still trying to find information. They would cut to him almost between every match. I think they did between every match.
Just about,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and he would always, you know, just sprinkle in enough to keep the story moving along, and I really enjoyed that aspect of the show as a whole. Watching it as a whole, it really felt like kind of a 3-hour saga that you were on.
Yeah, I think you nailed it, Chad, talking about the sense of a bigger story, the sense of unease. Scott, what did you think about that? Was that something you feel like WCW just kind of figured out how to do? Because up to this point, it wasn't really something that had been their specialty, I feel like, but they did nail it with this show.
Well, I mean, a lot of it does go to Mean Gene, who is, you know, the consummate professional and a guy who kind of very underrated, I think, in the role that he was. It's really not appreciated, you know, just what bringing him in did for the company, I think. Mm-hmm. Like it really did give them kind of a, you know, a cachet that they didn't have.
Yeah, a legitimacy.
You know, a legitimacy, yeah. Like, Gene knew how to run the show back there like that, right? Like, you know, just watching the idiot interviews that they have on WWE these days, you know, be like, you know, oh, Randy Orton, what are you thinking right now? Like, you know, like, come on, seriously? You know, like Gene knew how to ask the right questions and control the interview. And yeah, I think it was a very important part of the whole thing because he was asking the questions that people were asking about that, you know, as you say, like later on, it got to be ridiculous with everything NWO overwhelming the show. But I mean, like, legitimately, people were going crazy at this point wanting to know who the third guy was. So,
right.
Yeah, it all fit in very well, I think.
I think a lot of that was that is the story of, you know, this is for another podcast, but the story of WCW was everything that works really well here tonight. You see them not know where to stop with it, but that's, you know, that's the story of WCW that's been covered now and again. Scott, I know you've written about it both in print.
That is indeed the story of WCW, yes. Take a good thing and beat it into the ground.
Exactly. And that kind of segues into this next match. Although I got to be honest, I really enjoyed the next match we're going to talk about. And that's Public Enemy against the Nasty Boys in this double dog collar match. And I say beat it into the ground because these teams fought a lot in 1996. And it was generally pretty much the same match. I mean, the Nasty Boys had really kind of been having the same match a lot since 1994, and that's kind of the standard WCW hardcore match. I mean, at this time, it's still 1996. Hardcore isn't necessarily a thing in the mainstream. ECW is pretty well known at this point. So, you know, they've got their style. And obviously that's where Public Enemy came from. But it was always interesting to me that WCW seemed to get there first in terms of getting hardcore on the big stage. And maybe that makes sense, you know, kind of the Southern roots and who they're working with. But I personally, I like this match. These guys, you know, none of them are going to be mistaken for Catch-as-Catch-Can geniuses. Catch-as-Catch-Catch-Can. I don't know how many catches I just used there. Certainly too many. But, you know, these guys could go out and beat the crap out of each other with weapons and just have a sense of kind of manic delight. The Nasty Boys win here. I think they generally did. I don't remember Public Enemy winning a lot in WCW, aside from their fluke title win. But, Scott, talk to me a little bit about the idea of hardcore wrestling in WCW before it would become in vogue, and how these teams handled it. Is this kind of like the best possible use of the Nasty Boys and Public Enemy to just throw them out in, you know, the middle of a show like this and just kind of clear the deck, you know, get rid of, here's kind of the demarcation between the first few matches and when stuff really starts to matter?
Well, it's one thing it really is a good sign of, I think, is the kind of the differences that they had up and down the card. Mm-hmm. I mean, even like just watching this card, like, right, you know, even though a couple of matches aren't great so far, I mean, you got the high flying cruiserweight match and, you know, like the big angry fat guy match, something with each other. And now you got a hardcore tag team match. I mean, that's some crazy variety for a pay-per-view. That's the kind of thing you don't see.
Absolutely.
Anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and it's even if it wasn't a great match, then yeah, it actually did serve an important purpose on the card, which was to give the fans something different and something that everybody else in the show wasn't going to do. So, I mean, even if it wasn't a great thing, you know, at least it was something different and it was a change of pace. And that's something that they actually, WCW really excelled at for a long time with their tag team division as well. They had a lot of different tag teams who could do a lot of different things, and, you know, really gave the fans a different look each time. So, yeah. I mean, it has its place. I mean, obviously they kind of beat it into the ground, but I didn't mind this match. I gave it 3 stars. My original review, and it involves beating on each other with a rubber shark, and, you know, that gives you some great Dusty Rhodes commentary moments. So, you know, I had nothing personally against this match. And I will say it was set up by an angle on Nitro, which was I had never seen before, because as I mentioned, this whole Nitro thing is all new to me. One of the really great angles I've ever seen, actually, where the Public Enemy cost the Nasty Boys a match because Johnny Grunge ran out dressed as Brian Knobs in the most convincing Brian Knobs impersonation that I have ever seen. if you haven't seen it, it's truly amazing. Like, Johnny Grunge comes out with his hair done like Brian Knobs and in the same outfit, and you would swear that it was Brian Knobs who was going out there to get pinned and match against the Steiner Brothers, I think it was. And like, that was something that was really kind of cool angle, I thought, and something that kind of gets forgotten in history to set this up. But yeah, I mean, it was a decent match. I liked it, and yeah, that's what Public Enemy does, and that's probably the best use that they could have had for him on this show, I think.
Scott, I think I'd be doing a disservice if I didn't ask the question that if that was the best Brian Knobs impersonation you've ever seen, how many Brian Knobs impersonations do you see on a semi-regular basis?
Well, admittedly, it's a very limited field of expertise, but
you're
right
there.
Really good Brian Knobs impersonation.
Hey, let's take nothing away from Johnny Grunge in this
case.
Let's
not take it away. Yeah, I mean, that's the best acting job Johnny Grunge has ever done.
Not those vignettes he did with Mikey Whipwreck back in ECW.
Well, those were really funny too for other years. not for great acting. I don't think anybody would accuse those of being great acting.
No, this was fine thespian work. Chad, feel free to talk about the match, but you mentioned the commentary a little before, and Scott talked about it too. And of course it's timely given his passing, but man, was Dusty Rhodes having fun during this match. This was the height. It's like Dusty Rhodes was in his glory calling any Nasty Boys match, but truly as a commentator, the American Dream Dusty Rhodes was put into that role to call Nasty Boys Public Enemy matches, I do believe.
Yeah, it's this is a really fun garbage brawl.
Yeah, I agree.
And it felt like kind of a younger brother to the Spring Stampede 94 stuff. Mm-hmm. You got the double camera and everything, some callbacks to that. And Dusty in it is I mean, I guess one of his, probably maybe his most iconic call as a commentator happened the month before with Sullivan versus Benoit.
Right.
But he gets some great lines in here, especially when they go to the beach setting and just all the puns, and gets to use plunder, and when the table wouldn't break for Rocco Rock,
he
enjoyed that too. Rocco Rock
wouldn't want to
be
that table tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, he bounces right off the table. So Dusty was a lot of fun here, and really, I think this show. Well, Scott talked about kind of the versatility we saw in the show,
yes.
But I also think it does speak to Dusty's versatility as an announcer, actually. Because he was engaged in the cruiserweight stuff too, really kind of throwing to Tanay in that cruiserweight match. But then, you know, in this match, he had a ton of fun too, calling the weapon shots and what have you.
I think that's what you got to say about Dusty the commentator. I mean, certainly plenty of tribute has been paid to Dusty the performer, Dusty the wrestler, everything over the last few weeks. So Dusty the commentator is, you never got the sense he wasn't full on enjoying himself. And really invested, whether it was something like this where he loves a good brawl, or if it was something like cruiserweight wrestling where it almost seemed to kind of like baffle him, but he was fascinated by it and wanted to learn more. Like, that was his way of showing respect. I do agree with you, Chad. I think this may have been one of his fine performances. Is this the match where he debuts the like double trouble bash at the beach bubble for the
double trouble bash at the beach bubble? That's right. Yeah,
that's this match, right?
You betcha.
Oh, that's right up there with There's a Lady in the Men's Room for me. The all-time classic Dusty Rhodes calls.
I don't know if y'all seen a clip, but it's on YouTube. There's a big Bubba match. It's on like a random Saturday night or maybe even a syndicated show, but he grabs a bicycle from ringside.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's in the echelon of Dusty calls too.
I actually posted a link to that one in my Sporting News tribute to Dusty Rhodes, actually.
Nice.
That one stuck with me for a long time, yeah.
Shifting gears once again, Scott, you made a good point that they do really do a good job of never giving you the same match twice in a row on this show. And what we get next is Dean Malenko defending the Cruiserweight title against the unlikeliest of challengers in Disco Inferno. And now I remember reading your review of this match, Scott, both back when it, if not when it first happened, then soon after, but also reading kind of your retro rants on it, being that up to this point, you know, Disco Inferno was widely regarded as, you know, he was a joke, he was a gimmick, he was this and that. But this was the match where people, for better or for worse, for right or for wrong, started to take Disco Inferno at least somewhat seriously. No, he kind of proved himself as a worker a little bit here in this match, and he definitely takes a beating from Malenko.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it didn't last long for him because then he joked again afterwards.
Yeah.
Boy, the build-up for this match was terrible. mostly because, you know, you have Disco Inferno, who's, you know, a one-note gimmick funny guy, against Dean Malenko, who's, you know, the one person on the face of the earth with no sense of humor in this role. So it was a very interesting build-up, to say the least. But yeah, it was a hell of a match. I really liked this match. I would classify it as Disco Inferno's best match ever, quite without hesitation, I think. Mostly because Dean Malenko was just, as you just noted, beating the piss out of him for, like, most of the match, which is always good. This one definitely gave Disco some cred, probably led to him getting, you know, the TV title and a couple other things, just to show that he could escape the kind of one-note goofy gimmick that he had been introduced as at that point. And, yeah, it was just a really good match. You know, it wasn't Malenko's best match or anything like that, but again, it really showcases the versatility that WCW had at that point, giving something different in the middle of the card. And it was a cruiserweight match, but it was a totally different kind of cruiserweight match than Rey and Mysterio had just had as well.
Yeah, building on that a little bit, Chad, with the cruiserweight division, like we said, kind of still in its infancy and not becoming, you know, kind of the home of the Mysterios and the Guerreros as it would. And, you know, they were busting out a lot of kind of like more traditional WCW light heavyweight challengers. Did a match like this get you excited for the cruiserweight division? Did you think it had staying power? Was it something you wanted to see month after month?
Well, I mean, not at the time, probably not. But I think this match is one that really should be classified as a hidden gem. Mm-hmm. Kind of going back and prepping for this show, I probably hadn't watched this full show as a pay-per-view in a while, years. So I read up on Scott's review before I took a look at the show, and I saw his ranking for this one, for this match, and I was like, oh, wow, he must have been in a generous mood because, I mean, it is Disco, and I
doubt you just think, figured, but you know, no.
Yeah, but no, this match, I love this match. It told us, I am a complete sucker for matches that tell a story within mm-hmm. them. Even as much as I love a kind of a all-action spot fest that we had in the opener, typically the matches I'm most drawn to is a match built around a story or a body part work and just some good wrestling around it. And this match had it where you kind of had the evolution of Disco Inferno of all people beyond your eyes, and it felt kind of like to me like a drama series where they'll take this bit character sometime and have a standalone episode just about that character, and it really works. And Disco is it here, and I don't think Disco ever was as effective as he was here. And Dean, oddly enough, to me was somebody cool to play off of in this aspect, where he was a good ass kicker throughout this match and kept, you know, pushing the pace and really brutalizing Disco. And then Disco was get these little spurts of offense and kind of not resort back to his dancing and the gimmicks and really try to focus and almost pull it out. But Dean's able to get the submission at the end. A really, really good match that, to me, it really rounds out this show where I think most people would think about this show, you think the main event and you think the opener, but right. I do think this is a strong number three positive for this show, if you look at the show as a whole, and one to really watch. And I guess to get back to your original question about the cruiserweights over time, though, I think this also shows some good variety, but I think, honestly, this type of match to me felt more like a WCW TV title match that you may see in the earlier part of the decade or the late 80s, like an Arn Anderson, you know, very story oriented, a lot of wrestling, not as many high spots that some people might equate with the cruiserweight title. So it kind of feels like in the whole range of the cruiserweights in WCW, this feels like a match that's really good, but kind of different from the norm in some ways to me.
Well put. Five matches into the card, we've still got four to go. We're going to see all four horsemen in action. And then, of course, the huge, no understatement, history-changing main event. We've got a lot still to talk about. I am Ben Morse. You are listening to PTBN Rewind. I got Chad Campbell and Scott Keith with me. And after this break, we've got a lot more to talk about. But if you're looking for some other great podcasts to listen to, I've got a feeling you're about to hear about them right now.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner, at least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
The Place to Be Nation and Pro Wrestling Only are proud to present the PWO PTBN Podcast Network. Join us for a variety of great shows that explore all the facets of professional wrestling.
Join good old Will from Texas for our Place to Be Nation reaction shows and Goodwill Wrestling, which has been kicking since before JR had barbecue sauce.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play and join Chad and Parv as they discuss classic NWA and WCW pay-per-view.
And take in one of our newest podcasts, Exile on Bed Street, and allow Chris Zellner to give you a history lesson about important moments in wrestling's colorful past.
Listen to Johnny, Pete, Parv, and Kelly, the titans of wrestling, as they examine in depth the history of the WWF in the 1970s and 1980s.
And then there's Brainbuster, the wrestling game show, Tag Teams Back Again, the Pro Wrestling Super Show, the All Japan Excite Series, and the Super Extreme Vault for some ECW.
You can hear all of these great podcasts and more on one feed. Remember, PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network, part of the Place to Be Nation family.
Welcome back to PTBN Rewind for July. My name is Ben Morse. We are talking about WCW Bash at the Beach 1996. In our first half, we covered the undercard, gotten a lot of the players, both major and minor. In this second half of the show, I am joined once again by Chad Campbell and Scott Keith. Thank you guys for being here. And we're going to talk about the last four matches of the show, in particular the last match and last angle that ends the show. And we won't waste any time. We are going to look at the Four Horsemen. Now, the Four Horsemen had been rebuilt in 1995 and then again in 1996. In particular, at the Great American Bash, they had been going with just three horsemen for a while, with Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, and Chris Benoit, with, of course, their army of women. Well, I guess it was just two at that point. It was Woman and Elizabeth. But at Great American Bash, they added their fourth horseman, and that was Steve Mongo McMichael. Up to this point, former NFL legend turned WCW commentator. A bit of a joke, but WCW certainly seemed to see something in him, and they made him a horseman. There was a lot of build to his first big pay-per-view match taking place here at Bash at the Beach. And Scott Keith, I was hoping you could give us maybe a little scouting report on Mongo's opponent you took on that historic night in Daytona.
Well, you know, you have Chuck Norris and Jean-Claude Van Damme. You combine them together with the music of Nelson, and I feel you get the glorious being that is, in fact, Joe Gomez. Who I didn't come to appreciate fully on the level that I have until I started reviewing Nitro week after week like this, and came to realize everything that I was missing without Joe Gomez in my life.
The desperado himself.
The desperado himself. Yeah. That's right. You know, these, you might look at him and say, well, you know, sure, he used to be Alan Iron Eagle and a total jobber, but I mean, like, you know, look at his hair.
I did not realize he was Alan Iron Eagle.
He was Alan Iron Eagle. See, I have just filled you with the glory of Joe Gomez.
What tonight. A revelation.
I know.
So he was not, in fact, was he a Native American or was he a Mexican American? What is the deal here, Scott Keith?
Joe Gomez is all things to all people. He transcends nations.
He's whatever you need him to be.
He's whatever you need him to be. Apparently now he's such a great guy that he gives up his home to people in NXT now even.
Oh yeah.
Like new recruits come down to Florida and they just hang out and stay with Joe Gomez.
Oh, what would
No wonder they're turning out all this great talent, because it's rubbing off from Joe Gomez.
It's incredible. He's the true genius behind NXT. He's Triple H's secret weapon.
It really is true.
It's amazing. I do remember watching, you know, like a lot of people, I was tuning into Nitro kind of for the first time around this time in summer of 96, and didn't know who everybody was. Mongo, I got in early enough to understand, okay, he's an announcer. He used to play in the NFL. He turned. When they brought in Joe Gomez and kept building the fact that Mongo was going to fight him at the pay-per-view, and he came out and made the save, I think, for the Renegade, who ended up being his tag team partner, it really was to me like, oh, yeah, this guy's a big deal. Like, they're making him a very big deal. But his role here, essentially, is just to put over Mongo, which was weird to me because it was like, well, why didn't they just do this on Nitro? But they really built to the fact that, you know, Mongo was gonna beat this guy up on pay-per-view. What was the strategy here?
And the crazy thing was they had a storyline with this and everything. Where
where
Joe Gomez and Renegade were supposed to fight the Horsemen in the main event, and they got taken out.
Yeah.
So it was like Joe Gomez one-man crusade against the four Horsemen. And then they had, I don't know if it was after this or before, where they had the awesome video of like Joe Gomez and Renegade running on the beach, yep, and like the striptease while they're going through there and everything like that. And, you know, you'd think, you know, instant main event star based on that beach video alone. Sure. I mean, my God, they just print money based off it for years. But no, in fact, no, they just had Steve McMichael come out here and beat him with the Halliburton. And, you know, that's, I think history has shown that they backed the wrong horse in that case.
Absolutely.
I feel like, you know, Joe Gomez should have been the fourth horseman and the third man in the NWO and in the same time, and WCW would still be around today.
Still be around. They would have their own network.
I was fucking so.
It's a shame. Chad, was there any hope for Steve McMichael? Like, was it just a case of they had this guy under contract, he had some weird charisma, and they wanted to use him? Like, could he have been shaped into something, or was he really, did he become all he could be?
Yeah, I mean, I think too little too late.
Yeah.
Probably for him.
He was pretty old when he got in the ring.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I do have a little soft spot for Mongo because I do get a sense that he was trying. It didn't seem like, you know, just somebody coming in for a cash out.
That's true.
But yeah, not very good here, and certainly couldn't lace the boots of somebody like Joe Gomez. So.
No.
Terrible book.
We all agree.
I will say, though, that Steve McMichael did have certain something as a heel. Like, he was standing outside, you know, when you used him in the role of the guy standing outside the ring and cackling like a maniac with, you know, holding his briefcase while Deborah was kind of being the evil queen, you know. Like, that was a very effective role for him. If he was, you know, 20 years younger coming into the sport and learning, then they might have had something there. But
right, if he had been like the Luger role in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Although I think it was really amazing that Deborah McMichael, in all seriousness, went from, you know, sitting in the stands as a cheerleader, like literally the week before the turn at Great American Bash, and then just suddenly came out and started cutting these promos backstage with Mean Gene, sounding like she'd been in wrestling for, you know, years on there. That was actually super impressive on her part. Like,
that's true.
That was some good stuff.
Yeah, she was definitely natural.
So yeah, Mongo was 38. Oof. At this match, so he was late. Let me see. So when did he actually retire? He didn't retire though till 1994. So he, I mean, he played later on because I was thinking about that. Like, I wonder if he retired in like 91, 92 ish and just sort of hung out for a couple years. Because yeah, I mean, even a couple years earlier, he could have, I think, been a lot more effective. Yeah, Deborah was really good in her role early on here. She had the dog, and they said, I guess what they were implying, they traded in Pepe for this dog.
That was awesome. Yeah, Pepe's just gone. And they have
that was
this
a nice touch. Little poodle or whatever.
The horsemen were really, I felt like it was almost one of the, you know, you certainly wouldn't sacrifice the NWO and what it did for the business and what it did for WCW, but it almost was unfortunate that it felt like they finally did kind of get the horsemen back on track right before this after so many misfires over the years. But it felt like this particular unit with the three girls and, you know, Flair having a good time, Benoit really getting into his role and Arn, you know, being consistent. It felt like the Horsemen did get kind of sacrificed. And you know what? That's actually a topic we'll come back to in a couple of matches. But first, I want to talk about, speaking of Flair, he has a match here with Conan for the U.S. title, which is very odd, seeing Ric Flair in a 1996 challenging for the U.S. title. But the thing was with Ric Flair is it was kind of hard to figure out where to fit him because you had this overwhelming heel faction coming in. And this would be a problem for a lot of WCW heels once the NWO came around, is they couldn't do their particular shtick anymore. But also it's like Flair had his world title runs. He'd done this, he'd done that. Scott, do you think they had trouble finding a place for a guy like Flair, who's clearly a legend, still had something in the tank, still had something to give? What do you do with him in 1996? And is giving him a U.S. title run the answer, or was that just an odd fit?
Yeah, it was a really odd fit. He didn't do anything with it.
Yeah.
And he ended up dropping. I don't even know if he lost it officially to the Giant.
He gave it up because he was injured.
He had the shoulder injury. Crazy like that. It was really crazy to me. Flair and Savage were doing business at this point, too.
Mm-hmm.
They were legitimately turning the house show business around with the Savage as the crazy heel, Savage as the crazy, wrong baby face who's fighting for, he's had his alimony stolen, and Flair's got the VIP table at ringside every week in Nitro, which, by the way, one of the all-time great underrated angles that WCW did. I had no idea, since having never seen these shows, I just thought that was like one of the greatest running gags that they ever came up with, right? And they committed to that bit. And, that was classic Flair. And like I say, that was doing some really good business. And in one of the first instances, many, I found out recently that they were pushing really hard for Flair to actually join the NWO soon after this.
Huh.
So that's where they were kind of going with it, was that the intention was to tease Flair as a member, and then they, Flair turned down or whatever happened, and then they dropped it pretty much immediately from then. But I mean, that was kind of their idea with it, I guess, which would have been, that's would have been an odd fit to.
Would have been a very weird fit.
Yeah, but more importantly, though, I just goddamn hated Conan at this point. Like he was one of the worst U.S. champions in history. He was just so bad in this role. Like, later on, he found his niche as the ballin' gangsta, barrio street guy, and that was fine. But like this thing is like the badass Mexican champion coming in and winning the U.S. title. It was just no thank you. Like,
right.
This was terrible. There was a glorious moment where Flair just like rears back and just kicks him in the family jewels. I was just like, here we go. 4 stars for that right there. boom, done. It's tremendous.
Yeah.
Flair. And what I really love, Flair just cheats for.
Cheats like crazy,
and then and the best thing is, Flair being Flair, is he's booked to go over Conan cleanly after giving him repeated low blows, and he still pins him with his feet on the ropes.
Yep.
Just because it's Ric Flair, and he doesn't want to win clean; he wants to win dirty. And as a match, it was no great shakes, but you could tell Flair was having having a real career renaissance at this point. Like he was
having fun.
It's kind of a shame, that injuries or whatever kind of derailed it for him. But he was doing some good stuff here. The whole thing with Woman and Elizabeth, and that was just really great underrated stuff. And him going out and cutting all these crazy interviews, and Gene and the women having their bizarre reactions to it, and just playing off the bemused facial reactions of the women, and it was all just really great stuff. And you could tell Flair was having the time of his life doing it.
Yeah. So as far as the match itself, I would agree with you, Scott. I was not a huge fan of this match. And for me, what stood out was that it was definitely a clash in styles. I mean, Conan, for whatever he was not, a worker on the level of Flair. He was this weird hybrid, Mexican trying to adapt the American style. Flair going out there doing his character shtick. Chad, where do you think this match went wrong, or if you think it went right, by all means say where it went right, but do you think it was just a bad combination of opponents here?
I think Conan just sucks.
No, that could be it too.
I mean, I mean Conan, I've watched a lot of Conan plowing through the 90s, and I honestly of even with the top main event level stars that are not known as world renowned workers in ring, like your Sids and Ultimate Warriors, you can kind of see the charisma and see kind of the reasoning for why people would get behind them, and they had the crowd support. And Conan is just always somebody that I throughout his Mexico stuff, I mean, maybe it was the Conan the Barbarian thing, but it's something I've never quite understood why he was over. in Mexico to the extent he was, and certainly wasn't in ring. And then I don't think it really transferred as good in WCW. But one point I wanted to make about this, kind of with the Flair thing, is, well, there's two things. One, on the first Dangerous Alliance podcast, I thought it was really kind of astute when they did the Randy Savage kind of fantasy booking. And Will was talking about how somebody like Randy Savage, if he would have stayed in WCW, shouldn't be challenging for the Intercontinental title, because mm-hmm. that's sort of beneath him at that point in his career. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like that way to an extent with Flair here, but then I also look at a guy, what John Cena's doing mm-hmm. in modern day WWE with the U.S. Championship, and I think that kind of counterpoints that. So that's interesting. But overall, too, this for Flair, I think this show really signifies the last moment where I think for only maybe a month or two in 1999, but from this point throughout the rest of his career, Ric Flair was never either the top heel or babyface, position-wise in a company. And he really kind of was up to, even after he dropped the belt to the Giant, he was still kind of, you know, had the feud with Savage that was still going on. He still had his VIP table on Nitro. They had a pretty fun brawl where Savage dumped champagne and the food on Flair. So this is kind of certainly the beginning of the end where it never felt that way ever again to me.
Yeah,
I never really understood why they put the title on the Giant in the first place, honestly.
Like, yeah, it's an interesting story.
Watching it again now, there's no real build to it.
Yeah, because they have that one match a couple weeks before, and I guess it's when the alliance between the Dungeon and Doom and Four Horsemen goes awry. But it does when I'm plowing through 96 chronologically, it does feel like a real kind of sudden moment where, you know, the Giant pretty much just beats Flair clean and is now the champion. It's yeah. kind of a shocking result.
Yeah, especially since, like I said, the house shows were doing really well with Flair and Savage on top, and like
right.
for the world title, it was such a strange title change. Like the Giant didn't need it, and you would feel like if they were building towards Hogan getting the title back, that Flair would be as good a choice as any to.
Sure.
Have the title, pass it along to him. Like,
especially just, if they knew what they, especially if they knew what they were doing with the NWO angle. Flair is the perfect kind of WCW avatar to draw off the title, more so than the Giant, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that one makes no sense to me in retrospect or at the time. I couldn't figure that one out at all.
Going to what you said about the U.S. title, talking about titles for a sec, Chad. I think that was a good observation what you said about, you know, what Will said about the Intercontinental title feeling below Savage. I think it's the type of thing where you said Cena and the U.S. title's working, and I think that's because they've gone out of their way to say, for Cena to say, like, you know, the U.S. title is something I want, it's important to me, I want to defend it, I want to do the young guys thing. Here with Flair, they didn't really try to disguise the fact that it's like, we have nothing for him to do.
Yeah, it was an afterthought.
Yeah. So we're going to give him the U.S. title just to give him something to do. And he's obviously a bigger star than this, but it almost didn't devalue Flair so much as devalued the title, because it was like, he doesn't need this, but, you know, why not?
Yeah,
I feel like if they're going to go that route, they should have, like, rather than devaluing the U.S. title, they should have just put the tag team titles on Flair and Arn Anderson.
Yeah, that would be.
They were having some good matches. They would throw them out there against the Rock and Roll Express and guys like the American Males, and they'd go out there and cheat like crazy, and the Southern Cards would eat it up, and, you know, it would have been fun. Like, they would have been a good combination to carry the tag belts for a while, and then, you know, again, they could lose them to the Outsiders when they're ready. Yeah, would have been good stuff, but the U.S. title win, I don't know, it was nothing, and immediately, like, the shows afterwards, Flair comes out, and it's like, oh yeah, Flair's the U.S. champion, I totally forgot, because he doesn't
barely
carry the belt with him, and they don't acknowledge it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, weird.
Very weird. All right, so we have another horseman match here, the remaining two horsemen, Arn Anderson and Chris Benoit, taking on the aforementioned Giant, teaming with the leader of the Dungeon of Doom, that's Kevin Sullivan. The stipulation here being that
if Arn and Benoit win the match, one of them gets a world title shot the next night on Nitro, which is interesting because it kind of felt like people were, that wasn't such a big deal. Like you said, John Tenta, I think, gets a shot the next night. So odd stipulation, but really here just continuing to build this Horseman Dungeon of the Doom feud that was going on. Chad, you had talked about earlier kind of like the alliance between the Horseman and the Dungeon crumbling. Did it feel like, was this another thing that felt like it was kind of treading water? Well, everyone was so focused on the NWO stuff, you know, people weren't really, they weren't really thinking about this Dungeon Horseman feud, but, you know, they kept it going. Did it have any chance to still have life in this post or emerging NWO WCW?
I think it should have been over probably with the Benoit Sullivan street fight at Great American Bash.
Right, that feels like a natural endpoint.
Yeah, that just, they can move on. And I mean, they still fight, I think, at Super Brawl the next year. So even eight months afterwards, it keeps going and going. I mean, here
is... They fought at Bash at the Beach the next year.
That's right, a year later. It's absurd. So this is, to me, like your perfect kind of miss. I mean, you got the heavyweight champion, Giant, who feels, you know, he's the champion, so he kind of feels above a match like this. You got Sullivan and Benoit, who's still are trying to present a blood feud, but it doesn't have the same kind of intensity, and they end up brawling to the announce booth. And I mean, this is a show where we've seen some brawling when the Public Enemy Nasty Boys match that I thought was superior to what they did here, so that didn't work. And you get Arn kind of right at the tail end of his career. So this match to me is a mess. And honestly, too, like, I couldn't help but notice with watching this and retrospect, which you're always going to have now, is...
Yeah, of course.
I've not had a problem watching Benoit matches. I've been able to disconnect that. But when Woman comes out and is yelling at Benoit at the end of this one...
Yeah.
It's just uncomfortable knowing what happens at the end of that. So that kind of, the match wasn't good up to that point. Giant gets a pretty easy win over Anderson while they're brawling in the announce booth, and then that just put a damper on the whole thing. So honestly, to me, this, Tenta Bubba certainly was not a good match either, but as far as being a, you know, before the main event spot, this is one of the blemishes on this card as a whole to me.
And it's interesting, you know, this is traditionally the spot. It's like it's the popcorn match. You know, this is where you'll see the Divas or an unannounced match. And like you said, they get the world champion in this match, which is very odd. Scott, given what you were watching or what you are watching at the time, knowing a little more of the background, is there a better way these four guys could have been utilized on this show? Is there something different you would have done with them? You have had a world title defense, or would have... have kind of been overshadowed by the main event, no matter what.
I don't know. I you could throw a world title defense in there. Mm-hmm. The other option would be something like making it a six man, throwing like Steve McMichael in there.
Mm.
You know, with the Horsemen against, you know, like Giant Sullivan and one of the other idiots from the Dungeon of Doom. Right.
Having Joe Gomez join the Dungeon of Doom.
Having Joe Gomez. Oh, come on. Be cool, man.
He could be the Desperado in the Dungeon of Doom.
I would love to see what the Desperado would be in the Dungeon of Doom.
Have like a Zorro mask, I'm imagining. Yes.
The sword.
Yep.
Well, now we're just going to be let down forever every time we see Joe Gomez, and it doesn't happen. But
when Joe Gomez debuts in NXT, I hope that's what he's doing. Because it's coming.
Oh, we can only hope. I think you could have had Giant like just squash somebody, I think, or else like make it into a six man, something like that. It was just such a weird tag team match. Like, it was like, okay, this is, you know, they kind of wanted to do a Benoit Sullivan rematch, but then, you know, they threw other people into it. But it's like, as soon as you put the Giant in there, it immediately becomes this like huge mismatch is the thing too. Like even at the time going into it, it's like, well, nope, these guys don't stand a chance against the Giant. Like, he's gonna kill them both single-handedly, and that's pretty much
that
happened.
Was part of the storyline. Was they
that was the storyline?
They had to try to get the Giant away from the ring so they could beat up Kevin Sullivan, but ultimately came back and destroyed him.
Kudos for booking the Giant strong, I guess. But it didn't work. I don't
know. All right, enough said about that match. Here's what we came here to talk about, guys, and that is WCW against, at this point, they're actually, it's interesting, we've referred to them as the NWO the whole night because that's the easy shorthand, but they're actually not the NWO. And to this point, they hadn't really even been regularly referred to as Hall and Nash, as the Outsiders. They were basically just, you know, the Hostile Takeover, the Invaders. About a little over a month before, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash had showed up on Nitro, portraying themselves as Invaders, whether that was from the WWF or somewhere else. It was from the WWF. That's what they were trying to portray. But it was this invasion angle that captivated people like nothing else. At Great American Bash, they attacked Eric Bischoff. No one was off limits. They were going after everyone. The police were called multiple times. So it basically was building to this huge six-man tag, Bash at the Beach, where the Outsiders promised they would have a third guy. WCW did a random draw and came up with Sting, Lex Luger, and Randy Savage as their team. And boy, if they didn't make this seem like the most important match of all time. And it's something that, you know, you kind of have to suspend your disbelief in wrestling. And they did a good job of it here, of making you feel like, well, whoever scores a pinfall here is going to win this promotional war. When, you know, really, it doesn't, like, you know, even if they pin Hall and Nash, that's not going to stop them from coming back and doing what they've been doing. But you didn't think about that. All you thought about was, oh, my God, these guys have to win. The announcers did a great job. Everyone does a great job. I just want to hit you guys with some discussion points because I feel like, you know, there's so much to talk about with this match and this angle. And the first thing I want to talk about, and Chad, we'll start with you, is what was it about the Outsiders, about Hall and Nash, about both how they were booked, but also the things they did as performers that made this angle work and that set them apart from everyone else, not just in WCW, but in wrestling at this point?
I think it's just the difference in the presentation.
Mm-hmm. Could it have been anyone, though? Or did I think them
it being these two guys was nice because of their stature. You know, two big guys that made a name for themselves in WWF. If you can remember back that far, you know, they were both originally in WCW. So sort of for the smart fans, it's kind of a good callback that now they're coming back to take over the company that, you know, didn't want anything to do with them at one point in time. So that is nice, but just in rewatching the angle kind of in the primitive days, in the 90s, I think so far with the big two, I mean, the only thing I could pair it with was the Dangerous Alliance or Flair coming to the WWF. And in both instances with those, it feels like more of a controlled environment. I mean, you did have Rude debut as the Halloween Phantom. You had Flair come out on prime time with the belt, which was shocking moments. But again, mm-hmm. that was in a controlled environment. Here, right. You just had these two guys showing up whenever they wanted in the middle of matches, coming through the crowd, in complete anarchy. And the build to this match, you didn't really, I mean, you knew kind of what their overall motive was important, but I guess you still didn't realize how they were going to accomplish that motive, and they also kept referencing this unknown guy, which kept being it great. And then I think, too, putting Bischoff through the table at Great American Bash is just an awesome moment that mm-hmm. you really didn't see much, and too, where that type of authority figure, which he was kind of referred to for the first time at his official role, and him getting, you know, jackknife powerbomb through the table, takes a great bump off of it. I think that really sets it off too, that these guys mean business. It's a lot going on, and just it's an incredible angle, I think, up to this point even.
Scott, same question. What about what Hall and Nash were doing to this point and the booking made it so this angle was everything Chad just said it was in terms of just being memorable and just set apart from anything that had come before?
Well, I mean, aside from all the other revolutionary aspects of it, it was just it was really well done work on their part, because they were two heels who had a really clear motivation, and fans had a really clear motivation as to why they should dislike them. Like, there was you know, a lot of it was moving towards that whole Shades of Grey thing, right? But his this was like literally black and white, right? Like you had these two guys from outside the promotion who were coming in, and they said their goal was to take over and destroy the promotion that the fans love to watch. And that's something that fans can relate to, and something that, you know, they can understand clearly without having, you know, be explained to them over and over by the announcers. And that's kind of an underrated aspect of it, is like it was a simple, well-told story that drew money.
Yeah,
well, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why it really worked so well was that. And there was a lot of other happenstance with it too. Like the reason behind, you know, not naming the guys, right? Like keeping them as outsiders, was that WCW was trying to come up with, you know, some ripoff names of Razor Ramon and Diesel that they could get away with legally without being sued. But because, you know, WWF was so litigation happy at that point, especially with, you know, the angle proceeding the way it was, they did drop that, and just to be on the safe side, they wouldn't refer to them as you know, as any name, right? Mm-hmm. And as a result, that kind of gave it that, you know, a dangerous outsider edge to it, you know, because these guys are so dangerous, we're not even going to refer to them by name, you know, like that ended up being a really nice touch. That was kind of an unintended side effect of the legal troubles that were going on behind the scenes. So that's kind of another really underrated aspect of it, I think. And it was just and building up the third guy, which is, and another thing is, it's finally a wrestling angle that pays off big time. Like this is, you know, in an era of disappointments and, like, you know, Jimmy Superfly Snuka as the mystery partner of Survivor Series and stuff like that. This was a big time angle that was, you know, people were talking about, and it's like, you know, throwing all these speculations of crazy names out there, and it paid off. Like they did go out and they found the biggest and best name that they could, and people were not disappointed whatsoever in the payoff for it.
Before we get to that third guy, I want to talk about one other thing, and I'll sneak back to you for this one, Scott. Something else that made this unique to me was we had never really, at least not on this level, you know, maybe in a territory and or Japan or something like that, we'd never seen a group that unified all the wrestlers in a promotion. And they weren't quite at the point they'd get to later where, you know, the sworn enemies were fighting side by side, but this angle did require at least like the top level guys to kind of like readjust. So kind of some of the things that I know you've been talking about in your reviews of Nitro that were so great about kind of the Luger, Sting, Savage, all these guys not really being able to trust each other. They almost immediately adjust to the fact that, okay, we got to put all that aside because we have this far bigger threat to deal with. Was that kind of revolutionary to you, seeing guys just immediately drop everything and work together to the level they did against the outsiders?
Yeah, and it was a layer of realism that you don't normally get in wrestling as well. And something that WCW kind of forgot about in later years, which was part of the problem, is that there was this giant invading faction, and and seemingly WCW stopped giving a crap that they were being destroyed from within.
Mm-hmm.
Like this was, you know, this was something where it was, fans could really buy into it, that, you know, there was this invading faction that was coming in, and that's what really sold it, was that, you know, everybody on top in WCW was immediately pointed towards the direction of fighting off that invasion. And that was absolutely something that you just never seen before. And because every other invasion thing, like the Flair one, and you're talking about WWF, Flair was in his own little bubble, right? Like, you know, he came in as an invader with the NWA world title, but, you know, he was going against Roddy Piper and he was going against Hulk Hogan, but nobody else was really kind of drawn into it. And in this case, this was where Holland Nash came in, and it was an immediate threat to the announcers and to the fan base themselves. And the WCW guys actually responded how real people would respond. They came out, they were offended by it, and they decided to stand up for their promotion. And unfortunately, you know, only mere months later, they ended up looking like a bunch of morons who, you know, couldn't figure out how to deal with, you know, invaders like, you know, Sean Waltman and other, you know, huge threats like that. But yeah, for the early ones, right? Like this was major, major stuff, and really sold it for me as a fan, watching it like this, the way they came out and made it seem like it was an actual threat to the company and a real invasion.
The in-ring match here is not so much historic or important. It's what happens in the middle, which again, we are going to talk about in a sec, I promise. I'll keep teasing it to really build the suspense. But Chad, as far as the stuff we do see from when the bell rings to when Hogan comes out, what did you think just as far as, because this would be a knock on the NWO later would be that, you know, it was all flash, it was all interviews, but when the matches came around, they couldn't really deliver. As far as, because Luger gets knocked out early and it essentially becomes an Outsiders against Sting and Savage tag match, what did you think of the match itself?
Yeah, actually, I like the match better.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I remembered.
Yeah, me too.
There's that one awkward spot where Nash tries to do an elbow on Savage.
Oh God, you hurt. Yeah,
they really mess up the position. But the storyline's really strong. The booking, I mean, it's a well booked match from start to finish. Where Luger getting knocked out leaves that kind of, you know, gray line of doubt there. Sting's the one that hits him, so you got that. And then Sting goes nuts on the Outsiders and in a cool spot, and then he's really your face in peril. And this is, I mean, Sting as a worker is an interesting case, but to me, like, this in 96 is one of Sting's, honestly, best in-ring years to me, right in this area, because he'd had interesting tag matches with Luger that were kind of storyline oriented, and then the month before he had a match with Lord Steven Regal, which is another underrated match in my opinion, a completely different match, and here he's kind of your top face in WCW, plays that role well, takes a good beating here, gives the hot tag to Macho for Macho to go nuts. So I love the way this match was booked, and I mean, I've watched a lot of the NWO matches in the past couple of years from their heyday, and yeah, I mean, I think certainly most of the main event matches are probably on the bad side than good. They had a few gems. I really like the Slamboree 97 match, for instance, but I think this is one of the better matches. I mean, I'd classify this as a good match up to the finish.
Now, Scott, you said obviously you weren't able to watch Nitro in Canada, but you were getting the pay-per-views. Were you watching this pay-per-view live?
Yeah, and there's a story I've told many times about this one. But yeah, during this match, when I was sitting on the edge of my seat and losing my mind over it, my girlfriend at the time called me on the phone just to chat, and I was, you know, trying desperately to get out of that conversation as soon as I could, especially for the finish of the match was upcoming. So overall, I don't really remember much about the match, to be honest. I remember, I think it was decent, but the match itself is so unimportant compared to the angle that comes out there that I honestly have blocked most of it out of my mind.
Well, here's my question for you. When Hogan came out, did you right away, did the bells go off? Did you realize, oh my God, he's the third man? Which they kind of, it's interesting to me that the announcers, I think it's Bobby who says, oh my, like, is he the third man? Which is almost like kind of a, it was a tip-off that you almost wish they didn't do, but at the same time, it's kind of like, well, that, again, playing into the realism. Yeah, of course Bobby Heenan would guess he's the third man. But what was, first for Scott and then for Chad, when Hogan came out, what were you thinking?
Well, Hogan actually spoiled it the week before. He was,
oh, no.
Yeah, he was on a movie set. And, yeah, he was. He basically... he was on a movie set and basically told people that he was going to be the third man. So, I mean, I'd read about it in the Observer. Yeah. I'd actually read about it in the Observer the week before.
Wow.
But I mean, like, you know, knowing that it was going to happen and actually seeing it happening are two totally different things.
Right.
Like, you know, mentally you can say, oh yeah, Hogan's going to be the third man. But then it's like, you know, holy shit, here comes Hulk Hogan and he's going to turn heel. And like, I even knowing about it beforehand, I didn't think they were going to pull the trigger on it. I thought they were going to, I thought Hogan was going to get out of it or wuss out of it or, you know, or do something. And he did not. And, it was mind blowing. Like even that one was right up there with like the, you know, the all time things as a fan that, that just shocked the hell out of me. Like,
right.
Like I say, even knowing about it in advance, like it's still, I couldn't believe it was actually going to happen.
Now, if you thought they weren't going to pull the trigger, did you have anyone in your mind as, you know, maybe this is going to be the third guy?
Well, I mean, like everybody else, when Lex Luger got knocked out there, I thought, oh, okay, there we go. There's the there's what they're going to do. They're going to have you know, Luger come out and be the third guy instead, right?
But, and just like that, it becomes just another angle.
Just another angle, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what That's what I was worried about, but nope, they pulled that one out.
It's the one time they didn't let it down. Chad, what was your thought when Hogan walked out? And remember, you said at the very beginning of this podcast, you were a Hogan fan. You're a Hogan guy.
Yeah, Hogan's always been, as a kid, he was my number one guy. And I wasn't on the internet, didn't know who Dave Meltzer was at this point in time. So I was getting all my news sources from PWI, so yeah. Not the most reliable source.
They did not spoil this.
No, they did not have the big scoop on this one. But I think once Hogan does walk out, even before Bobby does the whose side is he on line, which is the line I was referencing to earlier.
Right.
I think if you've watched wrestling long enough, you're kind of preconditioned to not exactly assume everything is what they seem when stuff mm-hmm. like this happens, especially with the talk of the third guy and the build-up. It's almost like, of course it is Hogan. You know, something kind of clicked in my mind. And I do think my age at this point in time was a good age for this turn to happen, because yeah. I think about if I was 6, 7, 8, I'd have been devastated. But as almost an 11-year-old, it was kind of right at that peak where you're starting to just sort of get into your rebellious teenage years. So from Hogan being my favorite guy and finding new life and new edge, it really worked for me.
So for the one or two people who have somehow never seen this, Hulk Hogan comes out. He seems like he's going to save the day, rips the shirt off, drops the leg on Randy Savage. Him and the Outsiders beat up the referee, beat up Randy Savage, beat up Sting. Okerlund comes in. Okerlund, who we were praising earlier, comes in, does
the legend. Hold on. So I just want to add one thing there, too.
No,
he doesn't just drop the leg. He doesn't just drop the leg on Randy Savage. If he had done that, there, you know, people might have still been cheering him a little bit. He comes out, he drops the leg on Randy Savage, the Outsiders beat him up, and then he drops the leg on Randy Savage two more times.
Right. Yeah.
And Randy Savage is clearly dead. And it's like, that is a heel move.
And then the interview he does with Mean Gene, I mean, is almost like we talk about, there's just classic moment after classic moment, him coming out, everything to the Outsiders. But the Mean Gene interview is not to be underestimated. That was really where Hogan, like, immediately you can tell all the stuff he's been repressing for years as the fans have been booing him, just gives an all-time interview. I mean, Scott, can you understate like how huge that interview was and how perfectly executed it was and how long in the making it had been?
Oh, I know. And you know, the thing is, too, that Hogan wanted to be superstar Billy Graham for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, now he had a chance to just cut loose and do all the stuff that he wanted, which is really funny because, like, you know, they had to practically beg Hogan on hands and knees to turn heel, because Hogan did not want to turn, right? Like,
right.
He was like, you know, much like John Cena now, like, Hogan rightly felt that this would be costing a lot of money in merchandise. And it's kind of a good thing in that regard that NWO sold so many t-shirts to make up for him, I suppose. But like, it was a fight to get Hogan to to do this. And even leading up to the show, you know, you had all the vignettes on Nitro. There was like 3 or 4 of them after Great American Bash, where it's like, you know, Hulk Hogan coming back to WCW, like, you know, and making out that he's a, you know, a giant superhero and everything like that. So it's pretty masterful misdirect on WCW's part too, if that's what they were going for, to really get fans' hopes up that, you know, their hero was coming back to save him from these guys and then crushing their dreams like that. But yeah, like, Hogan just, because there was that period in 95 when he was dressed in black and, you know, burning the dirt sheets, brother, and, you know, all that stuff, where he was kind of working out some of that stuff. But yeah, you can tell this was one where he went out there and he just let it rip on the people who had been booing him for months now, and just said everything that was on his mind. And it was really great. Like, it was, because it came from a real place in him. It's, you know, it was another thing too. It's like, you can tell if somebody's out there, you know, they're, you know, playing a character that they don't believe in or whatever, but Hogan went out there and, yeah, you could tell there was something very real in that speech that he was giving to the crowd that night. There was some real bitterness and hatred that he was letting out there, and that made it all the more effective.
Right. Chad, you're praising the announcers earlier for the great job they did on the show, and I think they really nail it here, particularly Tony Schiavone, who, you know, has been fairly or unfairly criticized a lot over the years. But man, he, just in terms of his pure outrage And this is a guy who obviously, you know, is a WCW guy. He's outraged. Dusty's overwhelmed. Heenan has a nice role here where he basically gets to finally say, I told you guys, I told you for years, this is who Hogan is. And, you know, Okerlund does well. Talk to me a little bit about the announcers and if a lesser announced team or an announced team not as on their game, you know, we talk about the deficiencies in WWE announcing today. If this moment had happened with, say, the Raw announced team of 2015, how much lesser would it be?
Well, I even think if this would have happened with Bischoff as the play-by-play man, it wouldn't have been quite as good. Right.
Yeah, you really need
still,
Tony.
Still seminal, but I mean, you can see this around this time because Bischoff kind of relinquished his hosting role on Nitro, and he came back around this point and was doing some stuff on Nitro when the Outsiders would come in, and the segments with the Outsiders leading up to this match with Bischoff on commentary are just not as strong as the stuff when Tony was on commentary, and this is one of the finer Tony, I think, performances you'll see, especially the Hulk Hogan, you can go to hell right as they sign offline.
Yep.
That's a
perfect
just a complete
too.
Disgust in his voice. And like you said, Ben, I mean, Tony was a WCW guy, a guy that grew up going to Jim Crockett Promotions, was there throughout all that, had a cup of coffee in WWF, but he's really been the WCW announcer and voice throughout their tenure. So I think it was only appropriate that kind of the biggest betrayal that had happened in WCW history, he was the guy manning the call.
All right, guys. Same question for both of you. Certainly for myself watching this at the time, and I think for most wrestling fans, you got the sense that this was a huge deal. Just the fact that Hulk Hogan was turning heel was a big deal. The fact that the Outsiders angle was living up was a big deal. This wouldn't just end up being a big deal. It would end up changing the history of wrestling. It would end up giving WCW the edge in the Monday Night War. It would really create the Monday Night War. At this point, it was you know, in its infancy. But it would take WCW and then WWF to places they had never been before. So many characters, so many angles, good and bad, were born out of this. Watching this at the time, or even looking back in retrospect, could you tell how big this was going to be? You knew it was going to be big just because Hulk Hogan was a bad guy now. But, Scott, could you tell how much of a watershed moment this was going to be in the history of wrestling?
No, because I thought WCW was going to screw it up as usual. And admittedly, they did in the long run. But my feeling at the time was like, oh, okay, well, you know, Hogan's there now, and then what are they going to do to wreck it now? Because it's WCW, and like they didn't. They crushed WWF for, you know, another year after that in the ratings, and made them look foolish. And it took a lot of perspective to really realize that, you know, this was a real thing now that WCW had with it. And I mean, even at the time, I'm going back and reading Observers now, and the shows after this, they do the first 3.0 rating that Nitro did. And Raw starts to really plummet, and Dave's like, oh, well, you know, this is, you know, it's a post pay-per-view bump, and there's some artificial ratings inflation here because, you know, it's, they don't have the Olympics as competition anymore, and you know, but so even then, like, it wasn't really the realization that this was a real thing that was drawing real money for WCW, and from that point on, they never really dropped below 3.0 again. Like, it was just, it wasn't a fluke. Like, they suddenly became the dominant thing in wrestling, and it took about 6 months to really, you know, get the full grasp of everything that was changing with it. But yeah, I mean, at the time, I don't think anybody really expected it would be as big as it eventually would become, to the point where you know, WCW could sell out any arena legitimately in the country because they were so super hot by the beginning of 1998.
Chad, same question.
Yeah, I think this is interesting because, I mean, to me, I figured we'd get into a meta discussion about this, and I do think this is the most seminal moment in WCW history from the Crockett buyout. And I think at the time, I mean, when you think about, like, the biggest moments of the 90s, I think a lot of the memorable moments like Austin passing out at WrestleMania 13. To me, like, or even his speech at King of the Ring 96, I mean, those are great to look back in retrospect and see kind of the genesis, but I really don't think at the time, I mean, I know certainly me, I didn't think that was going to be like a watershed moment. I do remember watching this pay-per-view and kind of in the aftermath of people talking about it, that it felt like a big moment. I mean, how big? Where wrestling, I mean, this essentially kick-started the Monday Night Wars, where wrestling would become mainstream. You know, almost everybody in school was watching wrestling. You'd see T-shirts in the mall. You know, there was a big time in the late 90s where you couldn't go to the grocery store without someone in a wrestling shirt.
Yeah.
So I don't think you could, I guess, imagine that it would gain that big. But I do think compared to some of those other moments that people might point to as bigger moments throughout the 1990s, just a standalone moment in wrestling, this one, actually living in the moment, did feel bigger than those did. Whereas those kind of carried more weight from a looking back over time retrospective eye. This one is still a big moment looking retrospectively, but it also felt like a big moment while it's happening live too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of the stuff that, like I kind of alluded to, you know, the Austin, the rise of Austin, even though he had given the speech at this point, DX, so many characters, not just in WCW, but in WWF, I'm not sure they happen without the NWO, because the NWO not only instantly makes WCW's programming edgier and more mature, it opens the door for characters like that to suddenly be a thing. It opens the door, forces the door open for WWF to have to do something to step up and challenge this historic thing. So yeah, I think you're right on, Chad, with, you know, this may be the biggest moment in the history of if not just WCW, maybe in wrestling, certainly wrestling in the 90s, it's got to be right up there. So, guys, now that we've reviewed the whole show, we've looked back not just at the NWO, but at the whole undercard. Really interesting show. A lot of stuff going on, a lot of different kinds of matches, a lot of different characters either establishing themselves or on the cusp. I think everyone knows, you know, what you think of kind of the NWO moment. It's huge. It's big. It's historic. It's very well done. But, Scott, overall, this show, how did you enjoy it? What kind of snapshot did it give of what WCW had to offer at the time, not just from the main event, but up and down the card?
I easily rank it as one of the greatest pay-per-views of all time. But Bash, the Great American Bash 96 and Bash of the Beach 96, just this epic home run from WCW for those two shows. Like probably the two best back-to-back pay-per-views that anybody's ever done. And I've watched it many times, and it's like I say, I put it up against many other ones. It has the great opener. It has a main event that was really good with the greatest payoff of all time. A couple of more good matches in the mid card. It was a historic show. Nothing really, really terrible on it. And, like I say, it's great. I love it. I would put it in my top 10 of all time. No problem.
Wow. Full endorsement. Chad, do you feel the same way?
I mean, I think it's certainly a strong thumbs up show, has good wrestling, good spots, great variety that we talked about, and then the huge moment at the end. So to me, it's a show for everyone. It's a pretty easy show to watch. I watched it on the network prepping for this and was able to watch it in one sitting.
Nice.
Without any problem. I probably wouldn't be as strong as Scott in like the top 10 all time, just because there is a few low moments. But I mean, as far as a thumbs up, thumbs in the middle, thumbs down, this is a strong, strong thumbs up. If you hadn't seen the whole show, which there may be some, you know, fans that haven't.
Yeah, I feel like there are, probably.
I would definitely go back and watch the whole show as a whole, because I think the crafting of the story that we talked about throughout the whole show is really cool, and you get a lot of interesting characters and wrestling mixed in with that.
Well said. Guys, it was a blast talking about this. So if you guys are interested in checking it out, like Chad just said, go on WWE Network. If you don't have WWE Network, find it somewhere else. But this is definitely a show worth watching. Scott, of course, people can read your work on rspwfaq.com. You're also working for the Sporting News. What are some other ways people can see what you're up to?
In addition to those, I, of course, write also for insidepulse.com.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly the same stuff I do on my blog, but if you'd like to read it there as well, I'm sure Woodrow would also appreciate the hits from you there. And
I'm technically still on the staff page there, and I don't think I've written anything since about 2004. So.
Oh, well, there you go. And and of course, I post my pay-per-view stuff to Place to Be Nation as well, because always great guys and fun to be with. So I'm happy to help you out any way I can.
Yeah, Chad, what are you up to these days, man?
Oh yeah, so
do your shows come out?
Moving baby has put a damper on our show, but our next show that me and Parv are doing on Where the Big Boys Play is Wrestle War 1992, which is one I'm really looking forward to doing, looking back. And, you know, we talked about maybe the biggest moment in WCW history at this show, and I got a feeling that the War Games at Wrestle War 92 may be the what I consider the best match in WCW history, so we'll just have to see if that pans out.
There you go. Nice companion piece there. Well, guys, I can't thank you enough. This is a lot of fun. Big, important show, and really one of my favorite editions of Rewind that we've done so far. So thank you to Chad Campbell. Thank you to Scott Keith. Guys, next month, it's SummerSlam month, and you have voted. I have listened, and we will be covering SummerSlam 2002. Arguably, a lot of people have said one of the best SummerSlams of all time, so we'll be doing that next month. But until then, be kind, rewind. We will see you at SummerSlam.